Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, as always. And this week, my guest is the creator and the host of the MacCast podcast himself, Adam Christensen.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Hey, thanks for being on the show. You are also our glorious webmaster at the Mac Observer.
Yeah, I do that too. I wear a few hats.
You are awesome. You are such a Unix guru. I'm in awe of your Unix talents and skills.
Oh, I think they're paltry, but thank you.
Well, you were instrumental in our graceful transition over to WordPress. So yeah. My hat's off to you on that.
Thank you.
So as a Unix guru and a web creator and podcaster,
I want to know
how you got to all that. The other day we were talking about career path and how you started out. You started out very differently than wanting to be a computer geek, didn't you?
Very much so, yeah. It's a long, long, rambling path that sort of starts way back, and I won't bore everybody with my long childhood history, but the one thing that you need to know is from a very early age, I was always a kid who kind of knew or thought he knew what he wanted to do with his life in a lot of ways. And I don't know where that comes from. But early on, I had sort of figured out as a kid that I really had this inspiration to be a cartoonist, like a comic strip cartoonist, like, you know, the Sunday comics. You would come and you'd read those. And I liked drawing little cartoons and doodles and things like that. So that was sort of from a very early age, where I, you know, if someone asked me, what do you want to be when you grow up? That's what I would have said. And
is that because you had cartoons that you loved and you said, I want to do that too?
I think so. Probably Jim Davis and Garfield was probably one of my favorites when I was younger.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it was the 80s and it was kind of popular then as well. So yeah, I was a big Garfield fan. And I enjoyed drawing and doodling and, you know, and talking to grown-ups and things like that. It's like, oh, you know, that's a career. You can be a cartoonist. And I think I sort of latched on to that. But as happens, as you grow up and get older and wiser and learn the ways of the world, I sort of learned that, you know, making it as a cartoonist is probably going to be pretty difficult. And maybe you want to have a backup plan, or maybe there's another direction to go. And so when I got into high school, luckily, my high school, we had some classes that I could opt into where they were more technical. So I started taking art classes and stuff like that. And I learned about graphic design and illustration and those sorts of things. So then my cartoon sort of aspirations morphed into that. So when I went to go to college,
I have a question.
Yeah.
In high school, while you were doing that, were you on a particular technical track, or was it sort of like, you know, just the general stuff?
It was just luckily. Yeah. So my school just luckily had a program. Specifically, what the program that we had was, we had actually a printing press, and we had one class you could take that was basically graphic design, printing, page layout, and stuff like that.
But you weren't studying physics or chemistry or math intensely.
No, it was just general high school stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I was taking your standard high school courses, but you know, you have electives in high school, and one of the elective courses that you could opt into was this graphic design course. And it was kind of cool because we would lay out and print all the newspapers for all the different district schools, because we actually had that. So I got to run a little, you know, black and white printing press and play with film. And we had actually even a typesetting machine, like an old Linotype machine. We weren't allowed to touch that. The teacher was in charge of that. But, you know, she would print out film, and then we would, you know, use pasteboards. Man, I'm probably dating myself. And also there's people who probably know this who've worked in the graphics industry. But, you know, we'd print out film positives, and then you'd laminate, or you'd run them through this like wax thing, and then you'd put them down on pasteboards and pull out tape lines, and you know, then you'd shoot that and you'd make your negatives and then your plates and then go to press and stuff like that. So I'm kind of getting ahead of myself probably, though.
Don't worry about old time stuff. I remember doing that too, wax boards and printouts from an Apple writer. I remember.
Yeah, so I got exposure to that actually in high school, and that sort of developed into this. Well, I think I want to actually try graphic design, you know, maybe do logo design or something to that effect, you know, do letterheads for corporations and things like that. And, you know, this was right around the time. So I graduated high school in 89. So it was the early 80s. Desktop publishing was just kind of becoming a thing. I guess it was rolling along at that point. But you know what I mean? It's like computers were becoming these tools that were in that industry, and Macs were a big part of that. And so when I started looking around for, you know, well, how am I going to go to college, in California, where I grew up, in Northern California, California Polytechnic State University had a really fabulous, art and graphic design program. And I thought, well, okay, that's where I want to go. And their program, unfortunately, was very popular among people who wanted to do that career. So it was what's called impacted. And the way that you could get in, the only way that you could get in, was you had to submit a portfolio. And so they had some requirements for that. So along with your college application, you would submit this portfolio, and then they would select the students that they wanted to get into that program, assuming you get into the school. So you got to get into the school, and then you got to get into the program, right? And so I spent a whole summer working on this portfolio. You know, I had some things for my art classes, and I applied, and I didn't get in. And I later found out that I believe that year they had 30 slots, and they had something like 600 submissions of portfolios. Yeah. So you can tell how hard it was to get in there. So I was a little disappointed by that and frustrated. But at the same time, another thing, I was a huge swimmer all throughout growing up, from the time I was in second grade all the way through high school. And I was actually a top swimmer at my high school, had many records, and had been doing it for a long time. And so
I had been your 50-meter time?
Well, I was a distance swimmer, so I did the mile.
Oh,
I did
the
1650. Not just the 50. I think I got down to, I can't remember my best time, under 16 minutes. I know that. So, but needless to say, that the coach, I had been in contact with the coach at Cal Poly, and he really wanted me on his swimming program. But he couldn't do anything with the art department, but he could. There was another department at the school called graphic communications. It was a Bachelor of Science degree, actually. And what that meant is printing. It was basically studying to do printing. But what they had within that program was they had specialties, and there was a specialty called that was a focus on magazine and book design. So book layout and magazine layout and stuff like that. And what was cool about that was that you would take the same graphic design series through the art department. So the department I was trying to get into for graphic design, I would take exactly the same classes, which would be like logo design and typesetting, or, you know, type design and all those sorts of things.
That
and
worked out really well.
Yeah. So what you got to skip out on was illustration and art history and painting and sculpture and, you know, all of the fine arts, sort of, which I really wasn't all that interested in anyway. So it actually turned out to be the perfect program. And the coach could get what was called an athletic admit to get me in. So consequently, I got in, I think a quarter. Did I start a quarter late? No, I started on time, but it was too late to get housing. Or on-campus housing. So I was actually a freshman and living off campus, which is kind of a whole another story I don't think we need to get into, but that was interesting.
Another time.
Yeah. So that's when I got into that program. And so then I go to do the tour for that program, and you know, being into computers and technology a little bit more from like using Illustrator. Like, my dad had a Mac growing up. I wasn't really interested in Macs. I was interested in programming on Apple IIs, because my friends and I, we all had Apple IIe's and IIc's. I didn't have a computer, but my friends did, and we'd spend hours at my one friend's house, you know, programming in BASIC. My dad was a marketing guy and actually had a Mac Plus. Through one of the jobs that he was worked at, and then transitioned, they gave him because the company was closing down. So we had a Mac Plus at home, but I thought it was dumb because it had this tiny black and white screen, and it couldn't play any of the games. It didn't have a 5 1/4-inch floppy. I didn't really understand it as a kid, but I did
no
kind of
command
play
line.
Yeah, no command line, no BASIC that I knew of. Right. You know, so when we went to get our own computer, I lobbied really hard and convinced him that the Apple IIgs was just like a Mac because it had a desktop and icons and a mouse and all that stuff. But look, it's in color and all these other things. So we ended up with an Apple IIgs, which I love. I loved that computer as a kid. But yeah, Macs, I didn't know much about. But sort of roll back to this college program. So I'm doing the tour of the campus. I'm talking to the guy who heads up the department that does the magazine and book design part of things. And he was very proud to show off a brand new Mac lab that they had just built that had, I believe it was 6 Macintosh 2FX computers, which at the time, decked out the way that they were with the new bus cards and stuff that were in there, I believe they were about $12,000 to $15,000 machines with the displays and everything else. Just the box itself, I think the base price was $10,000, and they had 6 of them.
$1,990.
Yeah, $1,990. So I was very excited to get into that lab and use Photoshop on those fast machines, and it was great. It was absolutely great. So I think that kind of started my foray into becoming a Mac fan. It'd kind of be crazy about the Mac. And
you're not the first guest who told me this story about their family 2GS and then moving into Macs in college. Tanya Engst and some others. Path. Yeah.
I think it was you know, the times, and it reflects sort of what was going on at Apple at the time too, right? With the whole fight between Jobs and Wozniak over, you know, what's the future? Is it the Apple II or the Mac? It was interesting.
Yeah, it's important that Apple got those machines into the households so the kids could start playing with them. It changed our whole lives. Me too.
Yeah. So that's kind of, so in college, so I transitioned to this sort of more printing, more kind of technical side of things, but then started to get exposure again to the computers and technologies and, you know, raster image processors and PostScript and all these sorts of things. And so that started my inkling. We didn't talk about this yesterday, but I'm going to tell you this because you might get a kick out of this. So I started to realize I'm kind of interested in computers, and the internet was starting to take off. You know, I started to learn. That's when I actually started to learn about the Unix terminal, because I found out, you know, all students had email and we were given these Unix accounts on these Unix servers that the school had. And, you know, I inherited my dad's old Mac when I started to have to do, you know, projects at school. And so I'd want to work from home, and I kind of had a modem. And I found out you could get into, with a modem and a Unix shell, you could get into the library, like catalog system.
I did the same thing. I had an Apple II, and we had a 300 bit per second Hayes modem. And we discovered we could dial into the university computer and print our club newsletter.
Yeah. And so that was sort of when I started messing around with the internet, and, you know, at a very rudimentary level. But, you know, it was like Gopher was there, and I started learning about these things. And so that sort of also kind of started to kick off the programming, I think, tendencies. And I even end up, you know, as an elective one time, it wasn't even part of, I don't even think I was going to get any kind of graduating credit for it, but I thought, you know, I want to learn a little bit of programming. And so I looked up, you know, different intro courses in the computer science department, and I ended up signing up for and taking an intro to Fortran class. That was a complete and total disaster for me. I could not figure that language out whatsoever. And I worked harder at that class than any other class I think I ever worked at.
I remember doing the same. I'd punch my cards and I put a rubber band around them, and I put them on the computer science shelf, you know, in the M box. And then the next day I'd get my printout all wrapped around it, and it'd be pages and pages, and there'd be headers, and there'd be this input stuff. And finally on the last page, it would say syntax error, line 4. And I'd have to wait another 24 hours.
Well, ours wasn't quite that bad. We had terminals and you know, screens and printers and stuff like that. But point was is that I ended up just totally failing. So my very first computer science class, and only one I took in college, I failed out completely.
Well, you know, that happens. It just it's one of those things that happens in your life, and it doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. It's just a learning experience.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it didn't dissuade me, obviously.
Obviously. Obviously. So when you graduated from college, how did you land that first job?
Yeah, so that's an interesting foray, too, because, you know, so here I am. I've got this degree, and I'm looking at career choices and things like that. I'm kind of doing interviews. And basically, I'm trained to be an entry-level pre-press guy is kind of what I'm looking at as career choices. And I'm looking around and going, there's a lot of sales guys in printing right now, because printing was still big then, you know, slinging ink on paper and printing books and magazines and all those sorts of things was big when I was graduating. So I thought, maybe what I should try is sales. And so I ended up applying for and got a sales job with a book printer here just south of San Diego in a city called Chula Vista. I was living in San Diego. I had met my wife by that point. We met in college. We weren't married yet, but she had graduated a year ahead, and she was living in San Diego and working in the biotech industry down here. She's a chemist, and so I moved. I said, I'm going to get a job in San Diego. I was looking around, wasn't finding much, and I found this sales job, and I tried that. I think I was at that job for about a year and quickly realized that while I loved driving around San Diego and meeting with clients and doing the social thing, because if you can't tell, I'm a relatively social person. I wasn't particularly good when it came to like selling people on stuff. You know, I didn't like high pressure trying to sell people. So I did okay. I got a couple of accounts and did okay. Mitchell Manuals actually was one of the accounts I worked on here in San Diego. If you've ever picked up an automotive manual for a car aftermarket, it's probably a Mitchell Manual. Mm-hmm. So. You know, if you're trying to figure out how to change the oil on your Buick or something like that, you might.
Mine has a sign that says "No user serviceable parts."
Yeah, so they did they printed those sorts of things, you know, black and white books and stuff like that. But I sort of realized I wasn't really keen on doing that, and it wasn't going well. And then so I went to, they actually sent me, much to their chagrin, probably, they sent me to a printing conference in Long Beach. And I ran into an old professor and we got to talking, and I said, yeah, I'm not really kind of happy with this. I think I'd like to move back to the pre-press stuff. And he said, oh, well, by the way, I know an ad agency in Portland who's looking for someone. And so I called them up. And they were actually going to be in L.A. I drove from San Diego to L.A. to actually meet them at a hotel because they were there for some other client, and did a job interview and got hired. And so that we decided, well, we'll give Portland a try for a bit. And so we moved up to Portland, and I moved up there to work for this ad agency doing pre-press work. And so there I was doing the pre-press work, and they had all these old it was a smaller agency. I think we had like a half a dozen art directors and writers. And when I got there, they were using the 6100, 7100, 8100 series of Macs. And so I was given an 8100 series Mac, and the art directors
really
all had
Power PCs.
Yeah, Power PC Macs. And they were great machines. But by the time I got to that agency, I think those machines were 3 or 4 years old. So I'm trying to I don't have the dates up in front of me, and I'm always bad with dates of Macs. I have to pull up Mac Tracker all the time to check it. But so this is
8100,
late 90s,
been about early 90s, I would think.
Yeah. But so I got there, and they had these machines, and they were kind of aging and things like that. And people quickly realized at the company, the writers and the art directors, that, hey, Adam knows how to deal with extension conflicts, and he knows how to deal with the fonts, and he knows how to deal, you know, he knows how to make these things run. And because it was a smaller agency, they had a contract guy that would do the IT work, you know, the computer work. But, you know, you would call him up, and if you're on a deadline and your Mac's not running and you're trying to get something done, you don't have 2 hours or a day to wait for this guy to show up. And so more and more, they would pop into my cubicle and take me away from the thing I was working on, you know, the layout I was doing for this magazine, you know, this ad layout. And I'd spend, you know, time fixing everybody's computer so they could get their job done. But meanwhile, my job really wasn't getting done. So I was spending late hours, you know, basically doing kind of two jobs. And one of them was one that I wasn't hired for, nor was I getting paid for. And but I liked doing it a lot. And so I realized, hey, I kind of like this. So this was another shift where I was like, I was doing programming at the same time too. I started to learn about web programming and doing HTML. That was kind of taking off. Building websites, Netscape was becoming a thing, and you could now, it wasn't just like Gopher in, you know, Terminal and right. and those right. sorts of things. You could actually put graphics on the web, and it's like, oh, I know how to lay out graphics and make things look pretty. This would be kind of a cool merging of the technology and the design stuff that I like to do. So I started to do a little programming on the side. I found a couple people to do little jobs for, and I do basic forms with the CGI. And at that time, you know, you would use Perl as the back end. So back to the Linux, you know, Unix thing. But so I realized I like doing this stuff, this technical stuff, and I'm not doing the layout stuff as much, or I was trying to juggle it, someone's going to find out, the president or somebody's going to notice that I'm not very efficient at my job, and that's not really what's going on here. So I had the foresight to at least walk up to his office and say, hey, I want to let you know what's going on. This is what's been happening proactively. And I said, I'm really into this stuff. I think you're at a point now with your computers and your technology, you probably could use someone. That the company had grown big enough. And I said, I'd like to take on that role. Maybe you can hire someone else to kind of do the layout stuff, and I can take that on. And they let me do that.
That was smart.
Awesome. Yeah. And so then I started managing like their things, like their printers and their raster image processors, and that moved into they were actually sharing a network with it was a multi-floor office, and they had a design firm below them that they kind of shared with, and they wanted to separate those things. And so I did a whole network build out with Cat5 at the time, I think, and putting in a firewall and setting up email servers. And so I even learned more about sort of that side of the business, and it was great, and I was really enjoying it and everything like that. But at the same time, my wife, who was very much into chemistry and research, she had moved up to Oregon, and there was career opportunities there for her, but they were all in the production side of things, which means it's not so much doing pure science as much as it is taking science from other people, figuring out how to scale it up, figuring out how to make it into a viable product. So a lot of the work that she was doing was very repetitive. She just didn't really enjoy that stuff. And so we decided, you know, we need to move back to a place where her career can take her where she wants to go. And that brought a move back to San Diego.
And with that, that's a very good place for us to take a short break. Folks, we got a short announcement here from Kelly. We're going to break away for 60 seconds, and when we come back, Adam will tell us about his return to San Diego and what happened after that. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm here talking with Adam Christensen, the founder and host of MacCast, the glorious podcast. So yeah. You're back in San Diego. Finally.
So yeah, we're moving back to San Diego, and I realize I'm kind of doing more of the web work. I've messed around in the IT world for a little bit. And again, I think I get pulled back to, I kind of like the design stuff, but I still like the coding and programming technical stuff. And really the best balance for me seemed to be web development. And so in moving back, you know, my wife has great opportunities in her career. I'm like, well, I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to apply for web development position. And luckily got hired with Upper Deck, which is a trading card company. A lot of people probably know if you grew up in, especially if you grew up in the 80s like I did, but baseball cards and football cards and all that sort of stuff. But what they were doing was they had always been on, one of the things Upper Deck was known for was being on the forefront of technology. They were one of the first companies to bring holograms to trading cards as a form of verifying authenticity, because there was a counterfeiting problem in the industry that was going on. So they prided themselves on pioneering themselves in technology. And so they were kind of setting up a technology division that ended up becoming what they called Upper Deck Digital. And I got moved into that department. So it started out sort of building the website, and they wanted to build an e-commerce platform to sell direct to consumers online. So I was integral in helping build that out and set that up. And then that slowly morphed into trying to find other kinds of technologies that they could build into trading cards. Like one of the things that they did early on was they developed a CD-ROM trading card, and it was the little, if you've ever known the cut down CD-ROMs.
I remember those. They were what, three and a half inches?
They're about the size of a trading card or a business card. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we would print on the front, and then we would do all kinds of digital content for the inside of it. So you would pop it in your computer and it would fit inside the tray. Now, when Apple introduced the slot loading iMac, yeah, we ran into a problem. The company had to replace a few iMacs for people before we put labeling on them to say, don't stick these in your slot loading iMac. So that was a failure of, not a failure of the technology, but you know, one of those areas where the technology kind of didn't fit the time. But you know, and so we did that, those sorts of projects. We found, you know, and so I got to do some R&D kinds of things there too, related to computers and technology. So we looked at, you know, ways for using cameras and cards to like do recognition. So you could take a video camera and hold your trading card up to it, and through software and through the website, we could recognize what card you had and put it into like a digital portfolio online. We were looking into those technologies. We were looking into e-ink technologies very early on to see if those were viable. NFC, I remember, you know, we looked at a bunch of NFC things in terms of, you know, things that seem commonplace now, like if I think Disney had their Infinity, you know, little figurines, right, where you could unlock with a base station and games and stuff like that. So a lot of technologies we were never able to develop while I was there because they were kind of ahead of their time technologies. But
you were using an SGI really Indigo at that point, right?
That was back when I was working for the ad agency. That was our raster image processor. Yeah, but what was going on at Upper Deck was mainly web programming and development, and then the sort of research stuff that we would do looking into technologies, where the more and more ways we could build technology into the products that Upper Deck was
putting
out.
What kind of system are you using then?
At that point, I think, yeah, I guess I should mention this. This is why I can't remember what Mac I was using, because I wasn't using Macs there. They were an all Windows shop. So I was using Windows XP at the time, I think.
Oh, my condolences.
Everything I was building was C# .NET and MySQL, or MS SQL rather, which was fine. You know, I would use that during the day and curse at it, and then
Windows
and come
by
home
day
to my
and
Mac.
Max by night. somewhere I remember writing that.
yeah, I mean, and luckily it was the days of XP, which wasn't totally terrible. Or it might have been NT.
We
might have been using NT. It was NT. It wasn't XP.
NT was sort of like the original modern Windows multitasking,
right?
Memory protection.
Yeah. And my boss was just a huge Windows guy, and it was kind of fun. I mean, we'd have the little arguments, and the reality was like, my only problem with Windows, I guess, really at the time, was I spent a lot of time battling the machine rather than building stuff. That makes sense. Yeah, you know, rather than using it.
Well, that's the line I've heard from so many people, is the frustrations and the delays of using those kinds of machines, and the security issues too.
Yeah, but yeah. It was another opportunity to learn another platform, IIS instead of Apache, and MS SQL instead of MySQL, and things like that. But it was while I was there in 2004 that I discovered podcasts. I had a little bit of a commute, and I was driving back and forth, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of a cool technology. The iPod had come out, and I had the iPod, and it was like, oh, I can listen to these things on the way to work, and then, you know, get my news for the day or whatever I'm interested in. And so very quickly when I discovered podcasts, I started looking around going, well, you know, I'm into Macs, I'm into this technology. A big thing I would do when I got to work is you'd sit down and I'd go to, oddly enough, the Mac Observer, or to Apple Insider, or Mac Secrets, the one that got shut down, the rumor site.
Oh, Mac, yeah, rumors. Bringing back memories. Right.
But every day I would get to work, and I would kind of spend the first hour, you know, kind of waking up and getting coffee and going to all these sites to catch up on my Mac news. And once again, I realized this is probably not the best thing to do for your career. You know, when you're supposed to be working, checking out Mac news sites for the first hour. And I thought, well, what a great way if there was just a podcast that would deliver the Mac news, sort of summarize what's going on in the Mac community. I could get that on my commute to work, and then I wouldn't have to be doing this.
What
thing.
I'm hearing is that there was this lifelong lure. There were the things you did to put food on the table, and then there was this thing that was floating around in your head that was constantly,
yeah,
part of your passion and your vision and your lure, and that kept gently nudging you in a direction.
Pulling you and pushing, yeah, you in the direction that you should be going.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, so I was looking for this podcast, and it was very early days, right? It was very hard to find podcasts. There was no directory. It wasn't built into iTunes. Looked around, and there were a couple of great Mac web streaming shows, Inside Mac Radio and Sean King's Your Mac Life, right? They were both kind of doing things with real audio and streaming and stuff like that. Not technically really podcasts, but still doing audio things, but I couldn't get those as a podcast. So I thought, you know, somebody should make this podcast, and I guess since no one else is, it maybe can be me. And so I bought a USB microphone, and I had a 14-inch white iBook, which I absolutely loved. And I figured out RSS, and I knew how to set up a website. And so that's kind of how the MacCast got started in December 13th, I think, 2004 was the very first episode. And so I was kind of doing that on the side in my car. And then while at Upper Deck.
Awesome. Yeah. In your car.
In my car. It was the car studio. And the audio quality of the stuff of those early episodes kind of shows it. But everybody was in that same boat. So that was kind of the cool thing about being. This was the first time I think I was really on the forefront of a new technology ever in my life, which was kind of a fun place to be as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So how did
I started?
Did you?
Yeah. So I,
go ahead.
Sorry.
Did you try to make a career out of that? That's the point that we were thinking about. What I'm off and running now.
Not at that point. I mean, obviously, when I first started, it was just amazing to me that there were even people listening, because I didn't even know how they found the show. Like the very first episode that I put out, and it started out as a 5-minute. What I thought I was going to do was like a 5 to 15 minute quick summary of the news every day. Short show, and I didn't even ask for it or anything, but I threw the show out there, and I think on the very first episode, and I have no idea how this, I'm pretty sure I gave out an email address probably at the end of the show for feedback. Somebody actually emailed me with a Mac question. And that sort of started the genesis of the format change. It didn't change right away, but it planted the seed that maybe this thing could be a little bit more than just a, you know, just 15 minutes of news. And obviously, that if anybody listens to the show now, it's not what it's become. But yeah, not right away. So podcasting was taking off. It was starting to become a thing. It really hit when, you know, a few years later when Apple added it to iTunes, 4.9, I think was the first version, if I'm getting my history correct. And literally overnight, I think I went from 500 subscribers to about 3,000 subscribers. And then it snowballed over the next couple years from there. And kind of when I got to about 50,000 subscribers was when I was like, hey, maybe this is something that I can actually monetize and do. And it was just about that time when companies like PodTrack and some of these other companies were starting to form. And we had the Podcast Expo that I was going to for a couple years. Adam Curry was starting up what was called PodShow. Which was another thing to kind of help try and actually turn podcasts into a business. So it was just sort of starting. And that's when I decided I'm going to proactively at the next expo try and find a company that I can maybe monetize my podcast through. And that's actually how I found Dave and his other company, Backbeat Media.
Dave which Hamilton. Handles,
yeah, Dave Hamilton from Mac Observer and Backbeat Media, which handles the advertising for the MacCast. And that's an interesting, real quick, so I'll try to tell this real quick because I know we didn't talk about this yesterday, but I went to one of the expos specifically saying, I'm going to talk to all these companies, I'm going to see who can best represent the show. And what I was really interested in was making sure that I had a good fit of the kinds of ads that I would be presenting to my audience, but I felt a deep connection to the audience as well, because I think that's the nature of podcasting. And I wanted to make sure that what I was delivering advertising-wise made sense for them, because I really felt that's where the value of podcast advertising is delivering really targeted ads, because you're not going to have huge numbers like millions and millions of people, depending upon the show. I mean, back then, most shows didn't have more than, you know, 100,000, 200,000. I think Leo was probably one of Leo Laporte's shows were some of the biggest at the time. And I want to say back then they were maybe approaching a few hundred thousand audience, you know, so not like radio. So the idea that you're going to land, you know, these huge accounts wasn't really the thing. And it was more about delivering the right ads to the right people. So I was very interested in going to that show to finding that someone who could meet that relationship. And, you know, I talked to a couple of the bigger players and then I ran into Dave. And what was great about that relationship was he was a Mac guy. He had been working in the Mac community and he had already been selling ads to, you know, like banner ads and things like that to Mac websites. So it just ended up being this perfect fit. And that started the monetization. And the only reason I'm telling you about that is because that was sort of led to my next career change, which was things at Upper Deck were getting kind of rocky, just politics wise. It was the largest company I had ever worked at. I think only about 350 employees, something like that, at the office. But for me, that was a big company. I know for most people, that's not a big company. But there was politics in there, and I was kind of struggling with it. Decided it was time to leave and thought, well, maybe I can make this podcasting thing work. So I left. I tried that. That lasted about 6 months when I realized there just wasn't the volume there to kind of support it. And so I decided I need to go back to work, and I looked for another programming job, and I ended up with a company a lot of professional photographers would know called Nick Software, which is a photography company. They made high-end plugins for Photoshop and Lightroom for doing, you know, color correction or turning photos to black and white or doing color enhancements, focal enhancements, all those sorts of things. And I was brought on there to do their e-commerce platform. But what was great about being there versus Upper Deck was they were a PHP MySQL shop. And so I was given a 17-inch MacBook Pro, and that started my sort of foray of doing web development at a much higher end on the Mac platform, but using a LAMP stack.
LAMP?
Linux, Apache, MySQL.
And Perl.
And PHP.
PHP. Cool. I'd never heard that one before.
Yeah. Nice. If you're on a Mac, it's MAMP.
Hey, I heard the other day that Chuck Schatten has reintroduced Mac HTTP for Mac OS.
Huh.
I'm gonna check that out.
I did not heard that. I'm gonna check that out. Cool. And so what was nice about being at Nick too is they were very much a photography focused company, so I kind of got to get back into some of the creative sides of things in terms of, you know, we'd have photo contests, and they had a great place. They had a relationship with Nikon. They OEM'd Nikon's software that they would ship with their cameras when you bought one. And so they had a bunch of Nikon lenses and cameras that you could check out over the weekend. And so I kind of got to get a little bit into photography. I never got very deep, but that was kind of a fun place to work in doing that.
Cool, cool. And here you are today.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so I was there for a while, and then the podcasting thing, just to kind of finish up, the podcasting thing sort of started to take off again. Once again, being at a company, I was running into the whole politics sort of thing and decided it was time to move on, and tried podcasting again. And then
this time it stuck.
Well, and also at the same time, that it turned out that Dave was looking for a web developer. So, for the Mac Observer. And so I was like, well, that's great. I'm probably going to need some contract work to supplement the podcasting. And things just took off from there.
We are so happy to have you at the Mac Observer.
So that kind of brings me to where I'm at now. I do mostly podcasting for the income. I'm the web developer for the Mac Observer, and then do a little bit of contract work here and there in web development and PHP and MySQL. And now mostly, as you mentioned, sort of at the top of the show, WordPress, a lot of WordPress work these days.
Yeah. That's a really cool story. You know what the thread I'm seeing there is that you develop the skills that you need to move along professionally, and you keep enriching those, and you pay attention to that little guy and taps you on the shoulder and says, but what I really want to do, I really have this passion. And then you follow that, and then you merge the two.
Yep.
And turn that into a career.
I never noticed it as it was happening, but yeah, obviously with hindsight, you kind of see. And I think it's a good lesson to learn, and something I talk to my kids about too, is sort of don't be afraid to follow your passion and let it guide you a little bit. And you know, it's always hard to leave something that's safe and secure for something unknown, mm-hmm. but for me so far, it's worked out. So I think the other thing that's sprinkled in there, obviously, is I think some luck, a little bit.
Yeah,
but hard work and talent,
and knowing some
helps
people,
helps out the luck side of things, I think.
Keeping up those relationships.
Yeah. Also. And surrounding yourself with really great people, too. I mean, the relationships that I've formed over the years at all of these companies and still maintain them, I think, has been very important for my career. So, I still know a lot of the people from Nick. They actually eventually got bought out by Google. So anybody who hasn't heard of Nick, you maybe have heard of Snapseed, which is an iOS app, great iOS app and it's Google's product now. So they bought them, and, you know, at Upper Deck and all those people, you just maintain those relationships. And I think that helps too.
Thanks for sharing that story with us. That was just absolutely a bucket of awesome. I loved it. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
You're very welcome. And yeah, we are out of time. So tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Sure. Obviously, you can go to maccast.com and find out everything that I'm up to. You're welcome to email me. maccast@gmail.com is my email address, or you can follow me on Twitter, and it's just maccast.
Cool. Thanks again for being on the show. It was fascinating.
Yeah, thanks, John.
You're welcome. And folks, thank you for joining us and hearing Adam's story. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.